later on, we redid the flute part and going up the country because Alan wanted it even more perfect than Tank had played it. And he contacted Paul Horn, who is a famous flute player, jazz player, you know. Mm. So the original Going Up the Country has Tank Harrigan on the flute. And then the Going Up the Country that is on the Cookbook album, you know, the Best of Canned
Heat,
that one has Paul Horn.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't even know why. Alan, I think Alan...
And that was only, what, 2 years later?
That was about 2 years later, yeah. Alan said I think the original flute was a little bit out of tune. I don't detect it, really, you know.
Uh-huh.
But he was such a perfectionist and such a genius, that, you know, that we had to trust what he said. And he called Paul Horn, who in a way, it was more perfect, his part. But I still like Tank's better, I guess because I like Tank personally.
People didn't really know that the version that was on Cookbook wasn't the same version that was on the previous album?
Nobody could know it. Nobody could tell.
You played it pretty much the same except for
the flute
part.
The track was the same.
Oh, they didn't...
The only thing we changed was the flute.
Oh, I see. It was the same track.
The track is the same track.
Oh, okay. And in the not the Lost Performances, but the Woodstock movie...
In the Woodstock movie, we utilized the record version.
It was the record version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because to be honest with you, the live performance of Woodstock wasn't very good. To sing Alan's songs, even for Alan, for a big crowd and at the volume we were playing, is very difficult. I mean, I'm having that trouble myself playing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because those are songs that are, you know, to record them is different. But to play them live, you have to sing with this falsetto, you know, and they are songs that are designed to be sung relaxed and soft.
Yeah.
So Alan had trouble also in Woodstock singing that song live. When we revised the stuff, when we checked it out, we decided to utilize the record version, the recorded version.
Yeah.
After all, they had already eliminated us from the footage at the time when the original Woodstock movie came out, because we were not a Warner Brothers act.
Right.
That was like a political decision, you know, which really fucked with us too, you know, because, well, we thought and we still think that we were the hottest act there, and we believe we got the biggest ovation. I mean, you can hear it at the end of the Woodstock Boogie, you know, on the second record. And then we just thought that it was, you know, that was an unfair thing to do for Warner Brothers to leave a band like, for example, the Incredible String Band or people like that, that they really didn't do anything in Woodstock.
Right.
And to take Canned Heat out.
Yeah.
Just because they wanted to show the movie six times a day instead of four times a day. So they decided to knock off, you know, and they knocked off not only us, they knocked other people that were important too. They knocked Paul Butterfield out, they knocked Canned Heat. I think they did somebody, Grateful Dead, I believe, was there too, and somebody as important as that, you know. But many acts that got the acts just because they were not Warner Brothers. As usual, the big corporations controlling.
Like the band?
The band was cut out.
Yeah.
There we go.
Right.
And it must have been the same reason.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They wanted to promote their acts, and they wanted their acts to get famous.
Right.
But in spite of that, I still say Canned Heat is the Woodstock band.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody cares to rebut that, you know, or argue about it, they can go ahead. But I know what we did there, and the people that were there know what we did there. And even Warner Brothers themselves, they used the song as a theme.
Right.
For the festival.
Right.
You know, in the original movie, you know, the very first one.
It seems so appropriate, I guess, because so many people were coming up from New York City.
That's
and
right.
Other
that's,
places
why, that's why he called it up the country, because it was up to the Catskills Mountains.
Yeah. Well, being from the New York City area myself, we always used to say we're going to go upstate.
That's why Alan called it going up the country. And then there's sometimes people come to me and says, hey, play going down the country. And I immediately tell them it's not down the country because it's upstate.
Yeah.
You know, it's upstate New York.
That's
it's
right.
Up the country.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's the expression. Did Bob ever play any instruments in the band?
Bob both play harmonica
uh-huh.
in some of the songs, and he played some open tuning guitar.
Uh-huh.
Very little. He was limited on the guitar. And the harmonica, he was rowdy. He knew only a few notes, but he knew where to put it.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was good at that.
So his harmonica playing didn't compare to Alan's?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to find a harmonica player that would have compared to Alan. I mean,
right.
You're talking maybe Kim Wilson and Paul Butterfield, something like that, or the white guys, and
right.
that's about it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Maybe William Clark, too, you know.
Oh, yeah. I've met him. He's good.
Yeah.
What part of Mexico are you from originally?
I'm originally from Mexico City.
Okay. And you told me the last time we talked, a few years ago, you told me about how you're, you know, a music career started as you were still in school and so forth. But how many years were you playing professionally before you moved to the United States?
Well, I started professionally really in 1959.
Uh-huh.
So I moved to the U.S. in 1966, 67, around that.
Uh-huh.
So that was, you know, close
to
seven, 8 years.
Yeah, and you were pro all that time?
I was actually the most pro of the band.
Uh-huh.
Amazingly, you know, I wasn't very good at speaking English yet, or any of that. You know, uh-huh. I was still learning the language, but I was already. I had already gold records in the bands I played in Mexico with, and I had been on TV, and I had been on movies,
uh-huh.
and I already had experience on the road. You know, after me, I would say Larry Taylor will be the only other one that started very early too, you
uh-huh.
know, playing with Jerry Lee Lewis when he was 16 years old. So
uh-huh.
I would say Larry probably would be a little more pro than me,
uh-huh.
but we were in about the same.
What were a couple of the bands you played with in Mexico?
Well, I played some of the most famous bands over there. You know, one of them was called Los Sinners,
uh-huh.
and the other one called Los Hooligans.
Uh-huh.
And Los Hooligans was like a really top band, very, very famous, and I made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually did covers.
Mm-hmm.
And some Latin American rock, too, you know, rock en español.
Yeah.
Which is very big now, by the way.
Uh-huh.
But we started it.
Uh-huh.
And that's on the times where I discovered rhythm and blues.
Mm-hmm.
Because guys from up north, from Tijuana, etc., and from the Texas border, started coming down to Mexico and playing this Freddie King, James Brown stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I decided that was my train, you know, that was my expression. And I left those bands. I turned my back on the pop thing and on the bubblegum thing
uh-huh.
in around, I would say, 1963, 64. As much money as I was making and as much fame as I was enjoying, I knew there had to be something else to it.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I joined these bands and left the popular bands.
Yeah. Was there any difficulty in you emigrating to the United States? Did you have any problem getting to Los Angeles or being allowed to stay
here?
Well,
you know, I never had any problem finding jobs. Not only that, but before I immigrated, I came with a band here, which was originally Los Sinners.
Uh-huh.
It changed name to Los Tequilas to make it more agreeable with the American taste. And we came here and actually worked illegally for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we played some of the greatest places there were to play, and we were accepted and appreciated here, and we had a great time.
Uh-huh.
But eventually, you know, we got caught working illegally, and we got kicked out.
Uh-huh.
So that was done, that was in 65 or 66, around there.
Uh-huh.
I made a few connections then, and I realized that it wasn't really impossible to come here, because you're going to have to read my book when I detail more this,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
But, I mean, all our other colleagues and musicians down there will tell us, you guys are stupid, you know. You guys think you are God. You're bringing water to the ocean, they used to tell us. How dare you fucking Mexicans going there and try to play rock and roll in the United States? You know, that was the general consensus of all our other friends and colleagues.
Uh-huh.
Including some family members and all that. I mean, you're crazy. You want to go there and play blues and play rock and roll in the U.S.? You know, who the hell do you think you are? You know, you stay here, you know. That's what they used to tell us.
Uh-huh.
But we had that itch, that thing that we just thought that we could play. We were human beings. We had talent. And we said, hey, man, you know, we have a thing. We're Mexican. We'll be a little different. They'll like us. We sounded very good, and they did like us. And we started doing real good here in the U.S. Our first adventure, we got a lot of connections. We play, you know, we play the Troubadour. We play a place called the Lazy X, who was famous at the time. You know, Bobby Bland used to play there, Tina Turner, Ike and Tina, you know. And as I said, we play the Troubadour. We play the Daisy, which is a exclusive private club in Beverly Hills. I remember Paul Newman was there with his wife and other big stars, you know. So we were doing really good. And, but of course, we, one time we decided to go watch Help by the Beatles. And we took a bus to Indio, California to see the movie. Because we were working in Palm Springs. And right at the bus station, there was this Border Patrol guy checking out for wet bags and all that. And, you know, a few of us actually went through no problem because we look more white, you know, we're from Mexico City. But we had a couple of Tijuana guys that look real Mexican. And they got stopped immediately, and that's when they caught us. So they sent me back, and I went back to Mexico and worked for about a year there. And I knew this American girl called Sonia, who became my first wife, and that's how I married her. And then I came to the U.S. legally. I got my green card, my immigration, you know. And the story went on and on with Sonia and I. You know, she was my wife throughout the whole canned heat experience and all that.
Yeah.
You know, so she helped me immigrate here.
Yeah, I see.
She believed in my talent, and it paid off, because when we got divorced, she took a good chunk of it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You know.
Well, yeah, that's the deal, I guess.
So it wasn't really that difficult. And I was very lucky, because shortly after I arrived this second time, I was already in Canned Heat. You know, I joined very soon.
Now, you didn't play with Canned Heat at 1967 Monterey.
No, that was Frank Cook.
Frank Cook was still in. So how long after Monterey did you replace Frank?
Well, I joined the band right after the Denver bust, when, you know, the famous Denver bust of the song My Crime. I joined Canned Heat. According to my records and my scrapbooks, my first gig with Canned Heat was in September of 67. And we played with the Doors.
I see.
So I remember, I guess the Doors were opening for us, or we were opening for them, I don't know, but we played together. I recall I kept the poster as a memorabilia, you know.
Was that a club?
It was in a large club here in L.A. I don't remember the name. Yeah, it was a place.
So,
I have to have my scrapbook. See, my biographer has all that right now.
Okay. When is your biography coming out? Maybe next
Hopefully
year?
Hopefully by the end of this year. We're working on it very hard.
Good. What did Frank Cook end up doing in his career?
Well, Frank Cook, to start with, became Pacific Gas and Electric's drummer.
Oh, okay. Right after Canned Heat?
Because right after he left Canned Heat. The same people of Pacific Gas and Electric were people I was playing with, too. And we almost kind of exchanged drummers. They did a thing, and they exchanged drums. Don't worry about this. I won't take it.
Okay.
So, yeah, he became Pacific Gas and Electric's drummer, and then I guess he got fired again from Pacific Gas and Electric. And later on, I believe he became a producer. And now, I think I've heard he's a psychologist now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Did you, you know, so during, you say, 66, 67, basically, you came to L.A. to stay. How long previously, you know, before you joined the band, did you know any of the guys in Canned Heat or Skip Taylor or any of those guys?
Oh, I gotta tell you this story, but you know what? Let me get rid of this call,
okay,
because they are gonna keep trying.
Okay, sure.
Not answering.
Hold sure,
on,
go
okay?
ahead. Yeah.
But you know, they may bother us now and then. I met Skip Taylor with Los Tequilas.
Oh, yeah?
Before Canned Heat even existed.
Really?
Or before the idea of Canned Heat even existed. I met Skip Taylor, I believe, when I came the first time. In 65, I guess, with Los Tequilas and William Morris. He used to be a nice, clean-cut, totally straight, recently arrived from New York agent for William Morris. Mm-hmm. Recently graduated or whatever he graduated from, you know, I guess show business, whatever, you know. and it was amazing, you know, we met him and he put us in touch with other agents that later on continued to be part of Canned Heat. And, you know, the amazing thing is that we didn't really connect it until much later, about 2 or 3 years after I had joined Canned Heat. One time I just said, Skip, didn't I know you from before? And then we started going back, and I said, you are the clean-cut guy that I met out there in William Morris, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then we, you know, we connected, and we realized that we had known each other and met each other way before Canned Heat existed.
Huh.
It's amazing, you know, because we had such an amazing relationship.
Yeah.
And now he's back in line, you know, he just started his own record company, and he has just signed the band.
Yeah, and so he's going to promote the new album.
The new album.
Yeah. So, well, some people don't give him as much credit, I guess, as he deserves in the history of Canned Heat as
well,
being a key figure.
The credit he deserves.
Yeah.
You know, he...
Because he was also the band's producer, right?
He was the band's producer in some of the albums,
uh-huh.
And he was the band's manager.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the creative force, you know, and a lot of the push and all that came from Skip. Skip and John Hartman and Gary Effert.
Uh-huh.
The three of them were really the first force that held the band together and made the band famous.
And what did Gary and John?
Gary became quite known and unfortunately passed away the last year. But he was the creator of Filmix.
Okay.
The Film Appreciators Club and all that.
Right.
He produced a lot of films and he was really an art connoisseur and all that. But maybe in the filming industry.
Mm-hmm.
He was more into cinema. John Hartman later on managed several bands. John and Skip broke as we were still with Canned Heat. They broke, I think, in 1970.
Uh-huh.
And John went on his own and managed the Flying Burrito Brothers and managed the Eagles.
Uh-huh.
And manage several other bands, Ringo Starr,
uh-huh.
And I don't know what he's doing now, but he's back and forth. He's Phil Hartman's brother. I don't know if you know Phil Hartman.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's Phil Hartman used to be just a young kid. He used to come to our rehearsals and all that.
Oh.
And John Hartman is his brother.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So John's a bit older than Phil.
Yeah, a bit older than him. And as I said, he's been on the music business all his life.
Yeah.
Skip and John have been all their lives in the music business. They have a lot of experience. And Skip has a special charm to him, you know, and a very nice-looking man with a good-sounding voice, very coherent, very together, you know.
Yeah.
He got everything going for him.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, later on in the mid-70s, he got into drugs, and I guess we all did. And it was part of the decay. The band decayed, and he decayed too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now he's back in action, and he's back to probably even better than he was when he was younger, because now not only he has all the attributes that he had before, but he has the experience now.
Right, sure. Did you bring Antonio...
Tony De La Barrera.
De La Barrera. Did you bring him into the band?
I brought him into the band when Larry quit.
Uh-huh.
Because I have played with him before.
Yeah.
I knew him from Mexico.
Okay.
We both immigrated together.
Uh-huh.
And he was a very good bass player.
Yeah.
At the time, especially, you know, he played Hooker and Heat with us.
Yeah.
And he recorded Historical Figures and Ancient Heads. And did some other live records in Europe with us. Everything was going well, but then Tony also was weak, and he got into the drugs heavily,
uh-huh.
to a point where I felt so guilty about bringing him in, because he started messing up, you know?
Yeah.
And so Bob finally, I guess, fired him.
Yeah. So Larry initially he left after Henry. The first time.
Yeah, you know, the story between Larry and Henry has been a very history of conflict. They are both so different.
They always had a hard time getting along?
That's right.
Yeah.
They are both so different, and they are both so complex, and then at the same time, they are both so talented.
Uh-huh.
And there you have the two extremes. Henry is the extreme of looseness and drug use and Larry on the other side, who is a total perfectionist, doesn't get high, never did, that I can remember, and very critical, you know, and all that. So there was a collision there all the time.
Yeah.
And it got worse and worse as the things going on until right before Woodstock, Henry got really loaded and played this 30-minute solo where he even forgot the key we were playing on.
And, was that at the Fillmore West?
Excuse me?
Was that up at the Fillmore West?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Were you there?
No.
You know about that famous gig.
I just heard it was about 3 days before Woodstock.
Yeah, a few days.
Or maybe a week, yes.
Yeah, about a week. No more than a week. Less than a week. It had to be. Because that night, you know, Larry just said, I'll never play with this guy again on the stage. He's an asshole, blah, blah, blah. You know, he's an idiot. And Henry at the same time, he said, well, you know, fuck him. You know, the typical musician thing.
Right.
There is this thing going on the stage. I
right.
You know, I mean, Larry's came one way to the other, you know. And so Skip, as good as he could solve the problem, he just said, well, I don't know how you guys will do it, but tomorrow Can Heat has to show up and play a game.
Uh-huh.
And I want the Can Heat members to be there.
Uh-huh.
So we all show up, but Henry didn't.
Uh-huh.
And that was really the beginning of the end. The beginning of the
so
shattering thing. That, you know, the first time that the band really got shattered, you know.
Yeah. So Henry was willing to just, you know, capitulate and say, oh, okay, well, if that's the way you feel about it, I got better things to do, or what?
Remember that Henry was very drugged at the time, too.
Oh, okay.
And also, there was a thing about them, about all of them. I don't know about Bob. Bob probably not. Bob was more like me. To Bob and I, Can't Eat was the thing in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they asked me, do you want to join Can't Eat? I turned and I told Skip, I was born to play in Can't Eat.
Mm-hmm.
He liked that sort of commitment out of me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is when the band was not famous at all or anything like that. But Bob really liked that sort of commitment that I showed, too. I guess for Henry and Larry and even Alan, maybe, in their own sort of American boys, you know, American middle-class arrogance or something, they felt that Can't Heat maybe was just another band.
Uh-huh.
And they could maybe do better as
yeah.
they went on in their lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, they did other things. Henry recorded, had his own band, etc.
Uh-huh.
Larry's career has been brilliant. As you know, he's played with John Mayall, with Tom Waits, you know, he's got the Hollywood Fats band, he's done a lot of producing.
Right.
But I still insist that no matter what they've done,
uh-huh.
Can't Heat is still the biggest thing that happened to us.
Right.
And I'm the only one that stuck to it, you know.
Uh-huh.
I stuck to it because I always believed that it was just too good a thing to let
uh-huh.
it die.
Yeah.
You know, and Bob believed that too, of course,
mm-hmm.
but then Can't Heat also destroyed Bob.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let it do that to me.
Yeah. So you had you just asked Harvey to come in and replace.
It was almost a coincidence that at that particular gig on that dreadful Friday or Saturday night, you know, after Henry quit or got fired,
uh-huh.
you know,
yeah,
we show up and there is no guitar player. So in the first set, we hear that Mike Bloomfield is there,
uh-huh.
and so we invited Mike to sit in with us. And we play a great set with him. And we were, oh, man, you know, he's great. We're happening. We have somebody with control. We were real happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
And during the break, I told Bob, you better tell Mike to just join us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's not think about it. You know, he's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
He's perfect for Candy.
And he wasn't in a band at
he
that time?
He wasn't with Paul anymore.
Uh-huh.
And we asked him to join us, and Mike just looked at us and said, I love you guys. He says, I really love your band. But I just got out of Paul Butterfield, and I just don't want to be on the road. He said, I'm exhausted. I just can't make it anymore.
Uh-huh.
So he passed on it.
Uh-huh.
Then here comes the second set. And then we hear the same way. Harvey Mandel is in the audience. You know?
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, Mike, you know, Mike didn't want to join us, so we might as well try Harvey,
uh-huh.
who also had excellent credentials by
yeah.
being with the Chicago blues people, you know.
Yeah, with Charlie Musselwhite.
Charlie Musselwhite and Barry Golder.
Yeah.
And then we invited Harvey, and then again we play a very good set. To my taste, Mike was probably more appropriate. But Harvey was also, and it is also, an excellent guitar player that fits with Kenny Heath's music.
Yeah.
And we like his control, his volume, his, you know how Harvey plays.
Yeah.
He's very controlled, and he's a great guitar player.
Yeah.
You know, and also, you know, the thing about Henry and Harvey, both of them sound very much like themselves. They don't sound like anybody else. The moment Larry quit, we sort of let Harvey go, and we immediately rehired Henry. And that's when he came back, and Tony was hired. And that's how we did the Hooker and Heath record.
Yeah. And you, this is kind of the way John Lee Hooker wanted it, or did Bob want it? Because Bob was kind of designated as the producer of that album.
Yeah,
right?
Well, Bob, you know, of course, I was very familiar with Hooker's music since I grew up with John Lee Hooker, okay? I've heard John Lee Hooker and Jimmy Reed since I was a little kid. In Mexico City, we used to catch XCRB and the Wolfman and all that, you know, late at night. You recall that big radio station.
Sure.
Which was actually a Mexican station. Because in Mexico there is no limit to the wattage, the power and watts that you can have. So they will cover all the Midwest United States and Mexico with XCRB and XCRW. But Bob was an authority on John Lee Hooker. And Alan also, I mean, he was our idol, and we always thought his music was a main influence on the band. I mean, On the Road Again comes from John Lee Hooker and the Riff Ride Boogie and all that stuff. So one time we met John at the Portland airport, and that's when we discussed doing an album together. And, you know, immediately, you know, John has been always very friendly.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, I like the way you all boogie. I like the way you boys boogie. He knew about us. He knew how we boogie, you know. And then immediately we said, well, let's make a record together. Of course, he was in a different record company, and it took about a year for the record companies to get it together. And to finally achieve the Hooker and Heath project, which it actually lasted 2 days, because we did all the record in a couple of days.
Yeah.
Anything,
you know, I never had a copy of it until about 2 weeks ago. I bought a used copy of it, and I didn't realize that the band only plays on half the album. That the rest of it is just him.
Yeah, half is with the band.
Yeah,
with the boys. And the other half is divided with Alan, and with him by himself. See, we always thought that Hooker's music by himself was fantastic.
Yeah.
We even got an amp, like the old amp he used to use in Detroit, and we built a board so he could tap with his foot, and we could record that too, just like in the old records, like Boogie Chillum and House Rent Boogie and all that. We wanted to make that the same thing, you know, and recreate that sound. So the we wanted to open Hooker to the white audience. It was the beginning of musical integration. You know, you have to look at that as what was happening in the late 60s. It was like integration of music. It was the beginning of blacks going into white stations and white audiences digging on black music. You know, Hendrix is a major example there, you know. If Hendrix had come out in the 50s, they would have just called him nigger music, and he would have been very restricted to certain stations, you know, in the mid-50s or even late 50s. But this is already the late 60s, and integration is taking full force, especially in music. So I believe we were the vehicle for John to get known to the white audience. Because, you know, he was really not doing that well before we did this project.
And he says, on the argument, I don't take no 3 days to cut no album.
Yeah, I don't take no 3 days. And then he goes, if you want a triple album, you got to pay triple money. You remember that?
Right, yeah.
If you want triple money, you know, you pay triple money. I don't know. Yeah, that's right, because we just did it there. And, you know, and he also was amazed of how we follow him. You know, even to date, they did an interview with him in Rolling Stone after his famous Healer album. And he was asked, you know, who is the band that plays your music best? And he immediately said, the Kenny Heath. You know, the Kenny Heath. You know, he knew, because we were scholars of John Lee Hooker. We used to spend nights, hour after hour, smoking pot and listening to Hooker in Bob's house.
Uh-huh.
It was an obsession with us, you know, to examine him, to see what he did with the music.
Uh-huh.
And we always considered him to be maybe the most primitive and the most authentic, you know, blues singer of all times.
I think, particularly on that record, I love the way you guys do Whiskey and Women with him.
Yeah. Well, Whiskey and Women got play on black stations.
Uh-huh.
KGFJ, you remember KGFJ?
Uh-huh.
It was like a, I don't know if you were in L.A. then.
No, I wasn't.
But it was like a heavy rhythm and blues black station. They would have never touched a white record.
Uh-huh.
And they were playing Whiskey and Women.
Yeah.
You know, so Whiskey and Women was a black hit.
Yeah.
It got play on the black Detroit stations and in the South and in the big cities in New York and in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's a great album.